from the slug-infested studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another slimy hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. Slugs can quickly devastate gardens unseen and unnoticed because they work at night. I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll reveal how to crush their attacks with your own hair or dog fur. Plus, and especially heaping help in your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and languidly liberal lamentations. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like you picking up a slug fighting tool from the local Wiggle Waggle Dog Wash.
WDIY has been broadcasting in the Lehigh Valley and beyond for 30 years, providing news.
These planes were hijacked.
The Bethlehem Steel Corporation will end its steelmaking production in Bethlehem.
We hope that you enjoyed hearing from the Dalai Lama.
Local public affairs.
As I say, it's a race of interest.
What we're experiencing today will later on be studied.
And music.
My name is Janice Ian.
Our guest, Lake Street Dive.
In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Petey Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
WDIY, since 1995.
From the sustainable studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another wild hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's In the News, we report from a recent edition of the Washington Post. And we quote, Washington Post readers were eager to tell us why they love their no-mow lawns after we published a story last year about the concept. Here's a look at what some readers shared as spring gets into full swing and their efforts come into bloom. Rob Gerlach in Emigration Canyon, Utah, wrote to say that Salt Lake County required us to landscape with all native species. It was a challenge finding local nursery stock, and even harder learning firsthand which, quote, deer-resistant plants would survive nighttime nibbling. But we eventually found abundant options. We seeded the open spaces with native grasses and wildflowers, and each year is a revelation as long-dormant seeds burst into surprising new additions to the yard. I haven't had to mow once, thanks to the slow-growing character of our landscape, and our irrigation demands have fallen to nearly zero as the roots get more established, which is a huge blessing and financial gain in our drought-prone state. Bradley Holt in Birdsboro, Pennsylvania adds, I stopped mowing several years ago and the yard is now covered in white asters. Numerous young trees are also coming up. Red cedar, Virginia pine, oak, even cherry. Lots of bees and monarchs come to visit. This sure beats a lawn wasteland. From Julie Maynard in Middleton, Maryland, we haven't mowed the side yard of our rural lot for several years. In the spring, we enjoy blooming violets, then white clover. The patterns of the flowering grasses are beautiful in the early summer. By late fall, an increasing number of wildflowers, such as goldenrod and wild aster, come into bloom. From Chad Moore in Missoula, Montana, in 2023, we scrapped the old lawn in our backyard and planted a mix of native and non-native grasses and flowers. We mow the center of the yard to 3.5 inches, that's the highest our mower will go, and have taller prairie flowers positioned towards the edges. The bees and butterflies are amazing, and the soil is rich and full of earthworms. From Patty Bean in Plantersville, Texas, we only mow once a year, which allows native wildflowers to grow year-round. The density of our wild coreopsis increases every year. And finally, from Alex Jokay, Cedar Creek Township, Indiana. Many areas on our property are set aside for wildflowers. We mow only the high traffic areas and overseed those with clover, which grows lush, dense, and low to the ground. It's taken years, and we had some pushback from neighbors at first, but now we get compliments on how park-like our yard looks, and those neighbors now ask us for advice on naturalizing their lawns. Well, the photos attached to these testimonials are as great as the stories themselves. Look for them at WashingtonPost.com. The story was originally published on May 20th.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden. From the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, I am your host, Mike McGrath. In just a little bit, we will tell you about several very effective ways to get rid of the slugs that are eating your lettuce, tomatoes, hostas, everything out there. After another fabulous phone call at 610-694-8100. Neil, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thanks a lot for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. Where are you?
I'm at Sackville, Missouri, which is southwest Missouri, about 40 miles south of Joplin.
Okay, very good. We're getting a lot of action from Missouri lately. What can we do you for?
Well, I'm still having a problem with my garlic. It gets up to about 18 inches, and it just lays down and dies. I called you a couple of years ago about this, and you told me to separate the bulbs and the cloves and replant them, which I did. And last summer, everything looked fine. The cloves came up. All the ones that I didn't, I didn't divide up into cloves, they came up also, of course. Everything came up fine. They all got up to about 18 inches. Did the same thing. They looked fine, healthy, just all laid down within 24 hours and just died.
Now, let me make sure I remember, you were planting whole bulbs.
Well, I had transplanted my garlic about 5 years ago. First couple of years, everything was fine. They all came up, in the whole bulb. They'd come up, two and a half feet tall and put on the big flower head and then the seed and, go to seed and everything was fine. But then about 3 years ago, they started just laying down and dying on me after about 18 inches in height.
So you grew garlic successfully in this area for a good 5 years, right?
Well, it was fine for a couple of years.
Okay.
The third year is when they started laying down and dying on me.
Okay. Now, when you say they laid down and died, we're talking about the springtime?
Yeah, like right about now. They're up about knee high.
Right.
And I expect probably in the next couple of weeks, they're going to just lay down and die on me. Now, all the ones that I planted as cloves, there was over 100 of them. They came up last summer, looked good, just like the rest of the bulbs when they would come up. But then they did the exact same thing. They laid down and died when they got to about 18 inches height.
Okay.
And then now this spring, of course, they, in the winter, by Christmas, they're up 6-8 inches tall. But this winter, we had an extremely cold week where it didn't get above freezing, and couple and several nights it got below zero.
Mm-hmm.
Now all but two of my clove plants, and they look poor and sickly. Whereas all the ones that come up from the bulbs are, like I say, knee high. But I can only find two of my clove plants out there anymore. And there was over 100 of them, and they're all gone.
Well, you're not going to get good garlic planting whole bulbs. It's just not the right way to do it. There's really no place for the cloves inside that bulb to expand enough. The wrappers never form correctly. So in the future, I want you to go back to planting single cloves. Now, let's get down to this. When you say they lay down and die, have they lost their green color at that point?
No, they're still perfectly green, look perfectly normal and healthy, and I look for bugs and anything else might be causing them to do that.
No, it's not bugs. Have you pulled up a sample to see what's going on underground?
Yeah, when I pull them up to divide them into cloves, they look perfectly normal. I don't know if I told you this before, but I rescued this garlic from a old home site that was probably 100 years old.
Uh-huh.
It was along the roadside, and they were you know, widening the road, and they've been living for 100 years in clay and rock, and growing up, you know, 2.5 feet tall.
Well, that's great, but now I'm a little confused. So your greenery, quote, lays down in the spring, and then walk me through what happens. What do you do?
Well, I try to salvage as many of the leaves as I can, and I dry them and run them through the blender and make garlic powder out of them.
Excellent, excellent. You can also make a great garlic vinegar that way. But I'm confused about what's underground. Do you let any of these plants continue to a normal harvest time and see what you got?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of them just lay there on the ground and they eventually just turn yellow and die like they would do if they were standing straight up, you know, because they will eventually, like usually late summer, they used to just lay down or just turn yellow and die, you know, like any plant after it goes to seed, they would just die off and then come up in
okay,
the fall.
Okay, well, that's another mistake you're doing. As soon as that bulge appears at the top of the main stalk, cut it off. You don't want the garlic to go to seed. It takes a lot of energy away from the plant. The flowers are not that pretty, and when they go to seed, they make a terrible mess of like onion grass, garlic grass. So I do want you to cut off that bulge as soon as you see it. Now, again,
well, they haven't done that the last couple of years. They
now,
never put up a seed stock.
Now, when you're fed up and you just can't take it anymore, do you pull the dead plants, let's say, out of the ground?
Well, yeah. When you told me to put them, you know, do cloves,
yeah.
I let them completely die and dry out on the ground, the ones I don't pull and use. And then, of course, I pull all the dead stuff away and then pull the bulb up and broke them down into cloves and dried them and planted them.
So you are getting good garlic for a percentage of your crop.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, the
one. There doesn't seem to be anything wrong with the bulbs or the cloves.
Well, that's what we're growing for, man.
Well, I don't ever eat the bulbs. I just eat the greens.
So you're just growing for the greens?
Basically, yeah.
But you need the bulbs to get fresh cloves for the following year.
So I've been doing this for 30 years.
Okay.
And they've always just come up from the bulb. I've never bothered to separate them before into cloves.
You pull the plants out of the ground, and some of them have nice-looking garlic bulbs.
Yeah, the ones I pulled when I went to make cloves out of them to replant them. That's the only time I've ever done that.
So you do.
In 30 years.
You do that. What percentage of the crop does not head up?
None of it.
I think the lady doth complain too much. You've got greens. Now, I will tell you, If you're really growing it for the leaves, you can harvest those as soon as they perk up in the spring, and then they will regrow and give you another harvest. In doing so, I think they would remain much straighter. I don't know what's going on. Do you grow them in the same spot every year?
I've transplanted them. See, first they were behind the cabin, then behind the bunkhouse, then in the caretaker's front yard, and now since he's left, I've put them in his garden spot out back.
I wouldn't call that transplanting. I would call that planting the new crop in a different space, which is very good. Now, let's try, and is there any discoloration, any kind of rot at the soil line?
No, I specifically looked for that because I thought maybe that's what was weakening the stems, the leaves, making them lay down. And they all lay down the same direction. That's what's weird. You know, they don't lay down every which direction. They just all lay down in the same direction.
No, that makes sense because they're following the sun till the very end. All right. Pretty soon you'll be harvesting in a month or two. Then you'll be picking out your best cloves from those heads, and you're going to plan to plant those in a new area. I want you to do two things to the cloves before you plant them. One, dissolve some baking soda in, it sounds like you're planting a lot. So a small bucket of water, a gallon of water, but make a good baking soda solution and put the cloves in that. You know, you can pour the solution into a bowl and do runs, but let them sit in the baking soda for a good half hour. Then go out to the liquor store and buy the absolute cheapest big bottle of vodka you can find. It should be so cheap, the clerk might ask you, you're not going to drink this stuff, are you? and then you'll take the baking soda cloves, and you're going to put those in a bowl of the vodka for, you know, again, I'm guessing at what's going wrong here. Do it for a half an hour, and then plant them. The baking soda will be antimicrobial. It'll protect the cloves from any fungal matter or anything like that that's already in the soil. The vodka will kill anything that's on the cloves right away. So you've got a double help against any kind of disease or even a cultural problem. But it sounds weird to me, but give them the most sun you can, put them in the best draining soil. I would suggest that if you build a raised bed, this might not happen anymore because you'd have much superior drainage.
Okay.
All right. That's all we got.
Alrighty.
So,
okay, well, thank you very much. I'll try that and see what happens.
All right, good luck to you.
Thanks.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind you that this is the only time of year to prune spring bloomers like forsythia, rhododendron, and flowering fruit trees. Prune any later than this time and you'll be removing next year's flowers, which we doubt you want to Scooby-Dooby-Doo. But don't go sharpening your shears just yet, because we'll be right back to discuss several ways to stop slimy slugs and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past three decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up soon, we will tell you how to use hair to get rid of the slugs that are devouring your garden. We'll also have three or four other time-tested methods that cost you nothing except maybe a case of beer and are very slug effective. But right now, it's time for phone calls. Our number to call to reach us here, 610-694-8100, Michelle. Welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here, Michelle. Where are you?
I am in the Nashville, Tennessee area. I live on the hills outside the city in a lovely woods.
Again, I can't say this enough, how much I love being on Nashville Public Radio. It makes me feel like a country star, at least until I hear myself singing. Then that's over.
Well, we're very glad to hear you on the radio, too, so that's a good thing.
Yes, and I promise not to sing, which is a better thing.
Okay.
So
there's lots of people here that do that, that's for sure.
So what can we do for Michelle just outside of Nashville?
Well, I do live in this lovely woods, but I'm sensitive to poison ivy. And regardless of which door I walk out or which direction I head when I walk out a door, I run into big mounds of poison ivy. And I would like to remove it organically. And I know I've heard your gentleman speak about it who had a company that removed it, but I'd like to try to do something myself because I know that probably could be just a bit expensive.
Well, that is excellent. Thank you for reminding me about Umar. This is a guy who worked for the Philadelphia Zoo for 20 years, mostly on poison ivy removal. The zoo was a prime spot for migratory birds to drop seed. And, of course, there was a lot of ground, a lot of dirt, a lot of lawn. So it did sprout up everywhere. And when Umar retired, he started a company that you can't forget the name, which is the website name as well. IDon'tWantPoisonIvy.com. Now, now that's a name that gets right to the point.
Yes.
And if you visit his website, not only can you see his services and figure out whether that's the kind of thing you want to spend money on, but he devotes an incredible amount of space to training people to do it themselves. And he even, over the years, I've had Umar on the show probably every 5 years for the 25 years that the show's been on the air. And I've watched his style progress, whereby he has scoured the world over those decades and has come up with some amazing equipment. He has these gloves that are strictly poison ivy gloves. They give you a lot of finger feel, but then they have a portion that goes up your arm like a gauntlet, because people don't get poison ivy on their hands as much as they get it on their arms and legs.
Yeah.
So Umar has removal tips that I endorse, and also can sell you the equipment, pretty inexpensive, that you need to get the job done safely. Now, in the past, my advice, you know, poison ivy is truly allergenic. There are people who are immune to it, but it is the most common allergic reaction in America. You know, more people are allergic to poison ivy than anything else. And the degree of reaction varies greatly, and it sounds like you're the type of person poison ivy reaches out to as you walk past to give you a little brush.
Yes, I have to wear high boots when the weather is hot, which is not my favorite kind of footwear. And I have to wear protective clothing when I go out, and I still get little dips and drabs of it on my shoes or on my ankles or different places regardless. So that's why I wear boots and, you know, protective
okay, so
things.
What's your protective clothing like?
I wear boots, generally. Either wear hiking boots or high boots, more like rain boots.
Mm-hmm.
So I can walk that way. I always wear gloves when I'm out in the woods, and I would always wear long sleeves and either a long dress or slacks that you can tuck into your boot if I was out in the woods. And I've tried a few different things, and they all seem to be helpful but not maybe permanent.
Well, one of the big issues with poison ivy is first avoiding getting it on your skin directly, but
yes,
then getting it off your clothes and anything else you touched when you get home. For instance, if you're walking in the woods and you're wearing gloves and you feel safe, when you get into your car, have a plastic bag, carefully remove the gloves. Maybe have like a plastic bag from the supermarket in your car to pull off the glove and drop it into the other bag. Because if you don't, you're going to get poison ivy on the steering wheel. You're going to get it on the car door latch. You're going to get it on your door going inside on the doorknob or latch or whatever it is. So the advice is to get rid of anything that could spread it, like gloves. They're the big thing. And go straight to the laundry room. Take off everything, at least on the outside. Put it in the wash. Just run it on a cold wash. And you don't really need to add soap unless the stuff is dirty. And actually, not a cold wash, a lukewarm wash. One of the secrets that we can use against poison ivy is the uracil oil that has the allergic effect is water-soluble. So as soon as you wash it on your clothes, it's gone. It's back into the environment, and everything you put in the washer is safe to touch. The boots, I would recommend you get real Max, you know, rubber boots. And when you get home, again, using protective plastic bags to take them off, and then just rinse them off with a garden hose real well. And make sure you get the bottoms, and that will get rid of it there. Then if you're still worried, you have 20 minutes to get yourself into the shower and just rub yourself down with lukewarm water. You don't need any soap. Allergists, dermatologists recommend against soap and wash rags because you're going to spread it. Just use your hands to wipe down your body and you should be safe. Now, are you going to try to remove any of this? Because it sounds ubiquitous.
Yes, I've tried to remove some in the most common areas I walk. So in the places that I go, for example, to the bird feeder, I try to make sure there's no poison ivy on the way to the bird feeder. And to the garden hose, I try to make sure there's no poison ivy on the way to the garden hose. Places like that where I walk substantially number of times, you know.
But now you have a weapon specifically against what you just described. You're walking to the garden hose. If you have any thoughts that you may have brushed up against any, wash that off with your garden hose. But again,
Okay. You've
got a good 20 minutes after exposure before the reaction would begin to develop. Now, my poison ivy removal trick, real quick, is you assemble all those terrible plastic bags from the supermarket that you don't know what to do. Hopefully your supermarket takes them back, but generally you got a closet full of them. Get a rolling trash can. Wear gloves and long sleeves. This would be a great place to get those gauntlet gloves from Umar. Or, you know, there may be another source, but, you know, I love the guy. He does great work. And pull a plastic bag over each hand. Have your garden hose ready. Saturate the soil where the root goes into the ground. Really soak it. It would be a good idea to let the hose running around that root as you're slowly pulling it with a plastic bag on each hand. Then the rolling trash can should be open. You dump the poison ivy into the rolling trash can, get the garden hose, move on to the next. And if you saturate the soil and you work very slowly when you pull the plant out of the ground, you'll get all of the root system. And then once again, into the trash can. If you're out pulling a lot of poison ivy, say after the fifth vine, I would get fresh bags on my hands. But that's really it. It is that easy. And you just have to remember not only to protect yourself immediately, but not to carry it into the house. There are famous cases of people who strenuously avoided it and kept getting broken out in it. And they realized finally it was off their dog. The dog would come in from running around outside.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
They would pet the dog and they would get a rash. So sorry, pooches, but if your owners are overly sensitive, you're going to get a bath every day or else you're not going to be romping through the woods.
Yeah.
There are also protective clay sprays, clay lotions and stuff that you can put on yourself that are highly effective. And then, of course, you just wash those off when you come back inside. Then keep an area on the area where you pulled the vine out of the ground. Watch for any new baby plants. If any appear, have a spray bottle with vinegar ready. 5% supermarket vinegar is okay. But if you read the bottle, it says diluted to 5% acidity. So real vinegar is much more acidic than that. And you can buy horticultural vinegars. They're not that hard to find these days, especially in a hip garden center. Don't get it to begin with. And water is your best friend. All right?
All right.
All right, we got to
go. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Hello, my name is Rose. Just a note that I need my raccoons. I love them. They're great companions. And raccoons eat yellow jackets, so they're quite a blessing. Thank you. Love your program.
Well, thank you, Rose. I'm pleased to discuss this for a moment or two. I guess you're responding to our warnings about raccoons and they're dangerous. But you bring up a trick that I haven't thought about in ages. This will come up later in the season. By the time we get to fall, the yellow jackets have filled their nests with enormous number of stinging hornets, and they're impossible to avoid. And one of my friends, the late Dr. Jim Duke, who was the head researcher for the medicinal properties of plants for the USDA for many, many years, great herbalist, everything like that. Somehow the discussion got to yellow jackets, and I told him the trick that I use when there's just a hole in the ground. It's very obvious. I would go out late at night, and when the guards were kind of sleepy, I would spray, you know, any guards that were outside with Pam. Vegetable oil, no stick yellow jackets. And then slam a glass bowl down over top of the hole. And believe it or not, they would not be able to get out. They won't dig their way out. They're going to die in there. But one thing he said, he had a lot of skunks in his area. So when he discovered a nest, he would go out. He had some special red lens flashlights. And apparently yellow jackets can't see red light. But you always want to do this after dark on a cool night because most of them are down in the nest. And like I said, the guards are sleepy and they're not really looking to attack anybody. So he would have a jar of peanut butter prepared and he would pour the peanut butter over the nest. And again, with a helper, with a can of Pam in case any come after you. And he knew that in the morning, the skunks that were all over the place would have found the peanut butter. And then they are a prime predator of yellow jackets. You didn't go into any kind of detail as to how you would lure them there. But if you can get it close to the nest, hopefully on top of the nesting area, safely and get away, raccoons and skunks will tear that nest apart. They don't get stung or they don't mind getting stung, but it is a great way to eradicate a yellow jacket nest. So thanks for calling, Rose. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there that one of the paramount paths to having perky plants is the walkthrough daily inspection. Give everything a quick once-over in the AM, deal with any issues as soon as possible, and you'll prevent small problems from morphing into horticultural horrors. But don't go walking the walk just yet, because we'll be right back to help you get rid of slugs and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. What can you expect to hear next week? Hilarity, bad jokes, a small amount of useful information, and me. As long as these bolt cutters keep working. Boy, you know, this station must buy locks by the dozen. I'm Mike McGrath, and that's probably on the next You Bet Your Garden. Maybe. Plus your fabulous phone calls. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will tell you about several very effective ways to get rid of the slugs that are eating your lettuce, tomatoes, hostas, everything out there. Oh, it's awful. But it'll stop being awful when you hear what we have to say after another fabulous phone call at 610-694-8100. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Nice to talk to you again.
Oh, you are that Bill. Can I reveal your last name?
Yes, this is Bill Wong, and I'm here in Yardley, Pennsylvania, and with yet another question.
Yes, exactly, trying to become a regular on the show.
Exactly, but I just wind up having lots of things I don't know what to do with yet.
Yeah, you are the Greek chorus, then. You represent lots of other people who are facing the same issue. All right. What can we do for Bill this week?
Well, this one actually goes back quite a ways because we hit a bunch of trees, which unfortunately were dying off. So, of course, we had them cut down. And you know, this is way back when, before I talked to you. And, of course, I had the stump ground out.
Right.
And when that happens, you know, you fill it in with a little bit of dirt, but eventually it winds up sinking, and now my wife is trying to get me to level things out. So the question is, you know, how to be going about doing that, because there's sort of some grass growing in there. I just have the depression at this point and a hump around it. So I sort of have to take some down and bring some up.
Why do you have a hump around it?
That's just the way the thing wound up being after they did the stump grinding. They wound up kicking up some dirt off the side, so it's not real high. It's like, you know, an inch or two.
Oh, okay. That's not too bad. And this is in the middle of a lawn?
Of course, right in the middle.
And you say the stump area itself has shrunk?
Correct. That's down about 3 or 4 inches. So it's like there's a little crater there, and if you mow it just right, you don't see it until you step in it.
Right, which is why it needs to be filled in.
Exactly.
Well, you're in an excellent situation.
Mm-hmm.
Is there grass growing on the hump?
Yeah, there's grass growing everywhere at this point.
Okay. And is your lawn basically healthy?
Yes. It's been eating corn gluten meal for about the past 15, 20 years. So.
Oh, okay. So you put corn gluten meal down in the spring to prevent crabgrass and to give the lawn a gentle feeding.
Right. And that was sort of going to be the follow-on question, because if I was going to take some of this and have to reseed, I obviously don't want to drop it down in the fall.
Well, here's what you're going to do. Optional. I would recommend raking as much of the humpy area as you can into the hole on top of the stump and then get it level except for the depression. But as you probably know, unless there is a lot of bluegrass in your lawn, you are going to have to fill the hole in with, dirt, high quality topsoil.
Right.
Which has no meaning. So it may start growing actually in there, but you're not going to worry about that. You're going to wait till the heat breaks in August, although God knows what's going to happen. I mean, but at the end of summer and, depending on the weather, which means you're not going to get any more burning hot days predicted. The nights are arriving sooner. That's your best bet.
Okay.
That's when you want to fill in the hole with topsoil and then a seed matching grass.
Right.
Do you have any idea how to match your grass?
No, not really. So, and since I don't know exactly what was in there before, and it's actually a mix at this point, it's going to be kind of interesting.
Well, what I would suggest, if you have a good relationship with a local garden center, take out one of those humpy things and take it to them so they can see a patch of the grass. They're going to look to match the color, which some are greenish, some are bluish, and the blade shape. Some grass blades are very sharp, some are flat. So that's basically the two things you want to get as accurately as possible. So you'll fill in the hole, you'll sow the grass seed, you'll cover it with, say, another inch of topsoil, and, make sure you tamp it down so that it will be level.
Right.
Keep it watered. If it doesn't rain, this is one case where you can water like 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes at night, but just until the new grass is up.
Okay.
Then you'll fall back to regular watering, remembering that as winter approaches, lawns don't use as much water, so better to go under than over. But right. It sounds eminently doable.
Good, good. Well, that sounds like I can take care of that easily and level everything out, and everybody's going to be happy.
Yeah. All right. So we will await your next question.
Well, we'll see what we have when we try to replant stuff this fall.
Okay. I'm sure there'll be something. All right, Bill, always a pleasure to speak with you. You're welcome on the show almost any time. Almost. All right,
take care,
man. Bye-bye.
Bye.
As promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we are calling Hair of the Dog Can Deter Evil Squirrels. But what about slimy slugs? Maxine, who prefers to be called Max, in Cornwall, England, writes, would pet hair work as well as human hair to destroy slugs? Well, the original idea of using dog hair in the garden was to deter evil squirrels. That idea came from bulb growers in Holland who were testing different ways to repel squirrels from devouring their precious tulip bulbs, both in the ground and after they flower. No creature bothers daffodils, whose bulbs are toxic, but tulip bulbs are delicious and nutritious. In fact, the world lost many tulip varieties when Netherlanders were forced to delve into stored bulbs for food to avoid starvation during World War II. As most of us know all too well, evil squirrels love digging up and devouring tulip bulbs. But the Dutch wisely observed that dogs hate evil squirrels, and the evil squirrels hate dogs. So they collected dog hair from groomers and used it to literally mulch freshly planted tulip beds in the fall and mulch again when the flower stalks began poking out the following spring. These doggy beds were untouched, while nearby no dog hair beds were severely molested. Dog hair should be easy to find. If you don't have a personal Bowser, ask a friend with a preferably long-haired dog for their brushings, or ask a local groomer to save you a bag or seven. But we are supposedly talking about slug control here. On a trip to the UK long before I became a gardener, I learned that slugs were their number one garden menace. The cool, damp climate made living easy for slugs, and they repaid gardeners by eating everything they had to the ground overnight. The idea of mulching plants with human hair first began as a garden tip designed to slowly feed the soil as the nitrogen-rich hair decomposed. But it was soon observed that slugs got all tangled up in the hair, could not remove it, and croaked, leading many gardeners to rush to the local salon or barber shop for sweepings. Hair is hair, so dog hair, cat hair, and human hair will all work to tie up slugs. Just avoid using heavily treated human hair around your edibles. And we would be remiss not to mention the time-tested and very effective beer trap. You buy a case of the cheapest beer available in the largest size available. A combination that might make some of you out there start chanting PBR, PBR. Those initials, of course, stand for Pabst Blue Ribbon, a working man's beer from the 1800s that went through several periods of popularity and decline until around the year 2000, when it was unofficially adopted as the hipster beer. The low price certainly didn't hurt, and it soon became a sort of anti-status symbol. We seize on this specific brand as it is available at a low price in massive 40-ounce cans. A regular can of beer contains 12 ounces. And PBR lager has an impressive alcohol content of 4.8%, which is important as you need to get the slugs drunk for it to work. But a lot of advice on this subject is woefully inadequate or just plain wrong. Many sources specify using, quote, stale beer, which is as attractive to slugs as it is to people. Other sources either ignore the timing of application or get it wrong, which will not help you achieve the desired results. So gather your containers. We're talking full-size, empty cat food cans, pint size, or even better, half-pint size, plastic deli containers, chip plates, chip saucers, anything that can hold a decent amount of beer. Arrange the containers in the garden, especially around plants that slugs prefer, like lettuce and potatoes. Then go out after the heat of the day dissipates and fill your containers with fresh beer. As the sun goes down, the slugs come out, and they are then lured by the yeasty smell of the beer to their doom as the alcohol incapacitates them. In the morning, your containers should be filled with lots of dead, drunken slugs. Do not throw them away. Some research has found that live slugs are repelled by a circle of their dead cousins. Other sources, noting that slugs are cannibalistic, hope that their yeasty former friends will be eaten instead of their plants. Repeat this as often as possible, always using fresh beer, poured as the sun goes down. Hey, just like at your favorite human watering hole. In addition, try not to let your garden get overgrown. Space between plants is helpful for many reasons, including removing daytime hiding places and helping keep plant leaves dry. You can also lay flat boards, like fence slats, around your frequently attacked plants for the slugs to hide under when the sun comes up. Then at your leisure, or your leisure, lift up the boards and scrape all the hiding slugs into a bucket with a flat metal ruler. Have some soapy water in the bottom, unless you intend to feed the slugs to your backyard fowl, which we heartily endorse. And if you really like the idea of going slug hunting at night when they're active, use a salt shaker that you have engineered to have just one hole open in the lid, filled with the smallest, most refined grains you can find. And then try and hit each slug with a single salt granule. Such small amounts of salt won't harm your soil, but they will make slugs shrivel up faster than Margaret Hamilton. Well, that sure was some timely advice about standing up to slugs, now wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to sneak slugs into my lettuce patch if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100, extension number 3. That's 610-694-8100. And follow the prompts to You Bet Your Garden. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse teeming to our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. Either way, what do I have to do? I'm begging you. I'd get down on my knees, but I'd need help getting back up again. Always include your location, okay? Please, please. And be sure to visit our Facebook page for something new every day. Important updates about the show, a link to the written version of the Gardens Alive Question of the Week, and links to our priceless podcast. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created by Edgar Rice Burroughs and J. Allen St. John. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprup. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll still be coaxing my teeny tiny pepper plants to start growing up. Until I see you again next week. Yeah.